Welcome to TP Talks, PwC's Global Transfer Pricing podcast series, where PwC tax professionals share insights on today's key transfer pricing developments. Our podcast today is a special edition podcast covering the OECD's final paper on the transfer pricing aspects of financial transactions. Dan Pybus, a director in our London office, is the moderator for this series, so I will hand it over to him to kick it off and introduce the panelists who have called in to provide their specific insights. Dan, over to you.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Dan Pybus, a director with our London transfer pricing team specializing in financial transactions. Welcome to our episode regarding the OECD's final paper on the transfer pricing aspects of financial transactions. This special edition podcast series performs part of a three-part series focusing on the regional impact of the OECD's final paper. I'm here today with David Ledeur, a transfer pricing partner in our PwC Brussels office, Jörg Hulshurst, a transfer pricing partner in our PwC Düsseldorf office, Omar Mora, a transfer pricing director in our PwC Rotterdam office, and Michael Butler, a transfer pricing director in our PwC Cape Town office. Welcome, gentlemen. Okay, so the paper is now out. What are some of the key areas that are going to be impacting you specifically? David, maybe if we start with you first for Belgium.
The document covers quite some things, but there are a number of items that really stand out. I think the first one is the accurate delineation of the transactions and how it should be applied on financial transactions. So there is quite some commentary on the characterization. Is a loan, should it be considered for transfer pricing purposes a loan or equity, or partial loan and partial equity? So they focus on the arm's length debt capacity and whether the characteristics of the loan are truly a loan. What's also interesting to see is that the document underscores that it's not only about benchmarking interest rates. All terms and conditions should be arm's length. So you should look whether the whole transaction is commercial rational for all the parties. You should look at the options realistically available for both the lender and the borrower, where in practice, quite some people only look at the borrower, and the control of risk and substance more in general. So the accurate delineation is something that's really quite important in the document. Second item, which is interesting, is the commentary on the cash pools. And here you see that it's a consensus document, in my opinion. It's ambiguous on certain items, and they take quite some assumptions on the characterizations of a typical cash pool being a service provider. While if you look to actual treasury setups for most of the corporate groups, how they function in practice, they can seldom be seen as a simple service provider. But the OECD is saying that in general, a cash pool is a service provider. It will be interesting to see how that works out.
Thank you, David. I guess just before we move on to, I'll move to Jörg next, but before I do, could you just give a bit of a flavor as to what we mean by delineation? I know that's been mentioned several times in the OECD paper, and I know that speaking to clients over the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of confusion around what delineation actually means.
Delineation is what are the terms and conditions of the transaction. So the starting point is the contract. So for your transfer pricing assessment, you should look at the contract. But that's not all. You should see whether the contract actually makes sense. Would a third party have structured a certain financial transaction alone in such a way? For example, if you implement a subordinated loan, why is it subordinated? What is the benefit of making it subordinated? Is there a real need to make it subordinated before you go to the actual pricing of such a subordinated loan? So tax authorities could, for example, simply ignore the subordination if the taxpayer is not able to demonstrate the rationale for such a condition.
Understood. So it's a bit more of a kind of substance over form type approach to looking at these types of transactions.
Absolutely.
Okay, understood. Thank you, David. So then I guess, Jörg, we've heard a little bit there about what's going to be impactful from a Belgian perspective. What kind of things will be on the agenda from a Germany perspective?
I would say that several parts of the Chapter 10 of the OECD may not be very impactful long-term in Germany, just because 3 weeks before Christmas, the German Ministry of Finance published a draft regulation where they want to in the future put forward a regulation on financial transactions, which actually in certain portions includes a treaty override, meaning that in particular when it comes to the delineation of transaction, as David explained already, number one, but also to the pricing of long-term loans with respect to inbound transactions, there will be such a treaty override, meaning that the OECD principles may not apply in transactions like this. So that's why, of course, we are right now in a special situation in Germany, and actually the Ministry of Finance, who published that decree law, they wanted to get it out, obviously, before the OECD published Chapter 10. But now the law is with the coalition in Germany, and it is not yet finally decided. In particular, it's not yet finally decided whether the treaty override will survive and will be then part of the final law. Apart from that, it's somewhat the same issues as David mentioned. Number one, it will be in future the delineation of transactions, meaning the debt capacity, but also in particular the arm's length character of the terms and conditions of the loan. While in the past, we all know everyone was looking at the correct pricing of the intercompany loan, now in the future, we will also have to look at certain terms and conditions, in particular from a German perspective, the question of whether a loan can be seen as a collateralized or secured loan or uncollateralized loan is interesting. There is some recent Supreme Court decisions about this question. Related to this, historically, the German tax authorities have always assumed when it comes to rating that a group approach, implicit support, full implicit support by the group has to be assumed as the underlying credit rating, whereas now the highest German court, the Supreme Court, has decided that actually you have to look at each and every case individually, like the OECD in Chapter 10. But then it also has to be determined whether or not a third party would have granted a security in particular situation. And if that is not the case, because, for example, there is a bank loan which is senior to the intercompany loan and the security is already with the bank, in situations like that, you would have to demonstrate then in the future that even a third party would have granted an unsecured loan in the situation at hand. If that demonstration does not work, then there is a certain likelihood that part of the loan can be requalified as equity. Yeah, and then maybe the third point is the cash pooling, where also now I understand that the OECD, in particular when it comes to the two examples, and we'll certainly talk about it in a few minutes in more detail, that there is, everything is possible. The default position is the service provider, the cash pool leader being a service provider. But on the other hand, there may be situations where it can be demonstrated that the cash pool leader is more fully fledged and should get a significant portion of the synergy effects of the cash pool. Now, the German tax authorities have always stated that they only will accept example number one, saying that the cash pool leader is really a routine type of service provider, and there I expect that the OECD Chapter 10 will give us additional food for thought in future tax audits.
Thank you, Jörg. And I guess just to expand on one of your points there, or a couple of your points, the additional challenges which maybe are represented by the local legislation in Germany, and particularly the proposal by the Ministry of Finance, versus what's now currently in this OECD chapter, do you think that's going to lead to a lot more bilateral disputes on a go-forward basis?
Yeah, I can imagine that this will be the case, because I think in certain situations or certain cases, comparing the new draft legislation with Chapter 10 of the OECD, I think the German tax authorities, they obviously follow a marginal opinion, right? In some cases, it can be said, well, it may be covered with OECD, but in some cases, it's not. The question whether we will really get into, for example, a series of maps with Germany based on that new legislation in comparison with the OECD Chapter 10 really depends on the question whether the final German legislation will include such treaty override. because if the treaty override is in there, it will simply be impossible for the German taxpayer to enter into a MAP.
Understood. Thank you. No, very, very interesting. I guess then let's move on to Omar. In terms of a Dutch perspective, in addition to what you've heard so far, anything which strikes you as being particularly difficult or challenging from a Dutch perspective?
No, I think clearly the points addressed by David and Jörg similarly apply to the Netherlands, specifically the delineation of the transactions, the issues around cash pool structures and policies. I think next to that, what is particularly relevant for the Netherlands is the guidance or the limited guidance in Chapter 10 around properly remunerating treasury. So the Netherlands houses a lot of treasury centers for multinational groups. And the guidance in Chapter 10 seems to indicate or tries to delineate that activity as a sort of a service, whereas there is a sort of a step back where they also recognize and acknowledge that the functionality of a treasury center might be more in relation to risk control functions performed or more complex functions than you would expect at a mere routine service provider, and that is be then compensated accordingly, without defining what that means in terms of appropriate pricing. So I think this has certainly an impact for the treasury centers that we have in the Netherlands. I think next to that, the guidance that we see in Chapter 10 very much is already in line with how these type of transactions are already approached in the Netherlands in terms of delineation, in terms of supporting the terms and conditions, in terms of needing to support the volume. And I'm very curious how this guidance will be considered when the tax authorities are looking at the transfer pricing documentation that has been prepared for the years already passed, like fiscal year 16-17, and whether this new guidance will be applied to challenge the arm's length nature of these historic positions. So that's something to look out for.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you, Omar. It's going to be very interesting to see how that one plays out. And you mentioned there, I guess, the significant number of treasury centers and also cash pool leaders, which are located in the Netherlands. I suppose based on this paper, are you anticipating any significant reductions or changes to the profit profile of those treasury centers? Or do you think based on current legislation, the way things currently work in the Netherlands, things will be business as usual and the profit profiles shouldn't really change materially?
Of course, I think there is a specific regime present in the Netherlands for financial service companies, including these cash pool headers and these financial intermediaries. So the regulations in place should not be affected by the release of Chapter 10. I think more overall, I think the emphasis on substance and evidencing the risk management and control functions being present at these treasury centers and at these cash pool headers, as per the guidance in Chapter 1. I think that there we have already seen that has had an impact on how these treasury centers are set up. And that's also what I think going forward will increasingly happen, where these substanceless type of financial intermediaries will no longer be in place.
Understood. Thank you, Omar. I guess then moving to Michael next. So in terms of the reaction from a South Africa perspective, and I guess more generally from across the African region, what type of impact do you think the paper will have? Which areas do you think are going to be of particular interest to the African territories?
So from South Africa's perspective, I think the impact is very much going to reinforce what our revenue was tentatively saying up to now. They've been waiting for this paper before they've finalized any of their guidelines. I think the across Africa in general, in some of the smaller countries where transfer pricing is relatively new, and particularly transfer pricing on financial instruments is relatively new, and we're not sure how they're going to implement it. Some of them have got some safe harbors, others don't. For those, I think there's going to need to be upskilling of revenue officials, because this stuff gets quite complicated and the guys need to be trained to do that. So you're going to have from the, you know, say, a European investor's perspective, they've got a very sophisticated and complex transfer pricing policy and how to deal with all of this. From the borrower's perspective, you're then trying to convince the local revenue this is also arm's length, and they haven't necessarily had the necessary training to take it at that level. Some do, absolutely, some don't. So that's going to be practically, I think there's going to be a level of upskilling needed. And then I think we're going to get interesting clashes almost between other regulations. So in Africa, you know, South Africa and other countries, you've got things like exchange controls, where the central government, reserve banks, that sort of thing may limit the interest rates. Now, you've got the lender, which says, well, I've done a third-party analysis, and I think the interest rate should be 10%. But the Reserve Bank rules restrict it to 8%, for argument's sake. How does that then get dealt with? Because you've got conflicting rules, as it were. So do you have to then adjust the quantum of the debt to be able to bring it down into, so that you get into levels of interest which would be arm's length and within the exchange control regulations? Difficult to see how it's going to play out in practice. So it's going to be interesting times, and it's going to make for interesting discussions between taxpayers and revenues.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. Thank you, Michael. If we move then maybe to a different area of questioning. So if we look now to, I guess, the local legislation in territories, we've touched on a couple of areas there where the paper might contradict or may even support existing legislation in each of the local territories. Maybe if I can just ask each of you to touch on where do you think the biggest issues might arise based on what current practices are in your territory or based on what current legislation is versus what's in the OECD paper. David, maybe again, starting with you first.
I don't really see big contradictions. The Belgian authorities, and I think most authorities within Europe, they follow quite closely OECD guidance. Where I do see an interesting point is the interaction between the new transfer pricing guidance on the one hand and other tax guidance. And especially the thin cap or arm's length debt capacity, how that will interact with more mechanical interest limitation rules. So in Europe, we have interest EBITDA limitation rules, so all implemented within the framework of a direct. What is the relationship between those two rules? You've also general deduction rules for costs, how those will interplay with the new OECD guidance, because there are also some business-driven elements in those general deduction rules. And more generally, if you look to other anti-abuse measures like beneficial ownership and the like, they also refer to items as substance, business drivers, not tax-driven. So they all come a bit in the same sphere of this accurate delineation. So I think that will be an interesting point of how that plays out. Point is on the cash pools. So we all already hinted to it. OECD is of the opinion that in general, a cash pool performs no more than a coordination or agency function. This often does not correspond to the actual functional profile. In Belgium, for example, tax authorities have issued a draft circular letter, so it's not final. But in that draft circular letter, they took as a rebuttable presumption that the cash pool leader is a service provider. So it should not have the entire interest differential, but only a more limited service fee. I would hope that in the final version of that letter, they will be better aligned to the OECD guidance, but you never know. And the last item, it's more on the practical implementation of the policy. So on the pricing of long-term loans, I think what's in the OECD paper fairly well reflects commonly accepted principles. So what quite some group have implemented in the last couple of years, but also what has been accepted by tax authorities in the last couple of years. Amongst others, the determination of a standalone rating and factoring in implicit group support. Now, what's interesting to see in the OECD document is that they put a lot of emphasis on the qualitative aspects of the standalone rating and, of course, also of the implicit guarantee. Now, if you see to some groups, they have for the standalone rating only considered more quantitative elements because it's more easy to implement. And I fully have sympathy for that. Now, at the same time, OECD now emphasizes that you should also look at qualitative elements and you should document them. So it's not a tick-the-box type of exercise, but you have to give some documentation why you took a certain position on a certain criteria. So on that specific point, we will likely see some evolution in the future.
And David, just touching on that last point there, in terms of models being utilized by clients and advisors currently, I know one of the points in the OECD paper referred to the use of what's referred to as black box models, so kind of pure quantitative models, as you described. Is it in general within Belgium or what you're seeing across the European region, do you see the use of those models having increased, having declined over time? What's the current usage levels of those types of tools and methodologies?
I think when about credit ratings appeared like 10, 15 years ago, the use of software models was a commonly applied practice. If you look at the last couple of years, we see that groups consider more the factors that are also considered by credit agencies in their papers. So we have seen a gradual shift from more simple software tools to more tailor-made type of models inspired by credit agencies, but also tailored to the specific facts and circumstances of the group. Of this being said, there are also quite some groups that still use software models or the more metrics-based systems for good reasons. In the future, that might be a bit more challenging to solely rely on that. Now, as a corporate, you might consider to make a more refined approach, and maybe for the very small loans where it's not worthwhile to do a very detailed analysis based on the diligent manager principles, why not stick to the more simplified approach if the amounts at stake are fairly limited? But if you're talking about more material loans, there I would highly recommend to also consider these more qualitative elements in the analysis.
Thank you, David. I guess maybe then if we move to Jörg next, I know Jörg, you've already touched on a couple of the big impacts that are, or different differentiators, which when you look at local legislation might cause some issues versus the OECD paper. Any other reflections in terms of what the impact's like to be for in particularly German clients and customers, but also what you've been seeing across the European regions more recently?
Yeah, let me give you first of all maybe a brief summary of what's in the draft legislation and then to explain a little bit more in detail the contradictions. So the draft legislation actually consists of two different paragraphs. The first paragraph generally is dealing with intercompany loans, with the delineation of that loans and the pricing methodology. And the second part is dealing with the activities of financial companies and treasury. When it comes to the first part, actually, the surprising point is not only the treaty override, but also that it is only related to inbound transactions. So obviously, the German tax authorities see that the arm's length principle for German purposes has to be made clear only for inbound transactions, but for outbound transactions, the law is open. Maybe for outbound transactions, Chapter 10 has to be applied. The law doesn't say anything about this. And this is, first of all, of course, surprising and in a potential contradiction to the OECD, because Chapter 10, according to my understanding, tries to clarify the arm's length principle, irrespective of whether a transaction is inbound or outbound. Then secondly, apart from the delineation aspect, as I mentioned, which is, I think, broadly in line with the OECD, when it comes to the question of arm's length pricing of intercompany loans, the draft law clearly says that it is arm's length to look at each and every single subsidiary, but to determine the interest rate as if that subsidiary would work on behalf of the group, meaning that actually you have to somehow determine the interest rate by a hypothetical sort of test where you assume the terms and conditions of the intercompany loan, but at the same time assume that transaction would be with a third party where the borrower would not be the subsidiary but would be the group as a whole, which typically would lead to a result where the group rating has to be applied, which is I think in a contradiction to the OECD, because the OECD, when it comes to rating, implicit support and everything around this, follows a pretty detailed approach with qualitative and quantitative aspects, whereas the German tax authorities, they make this point and there is not much flexibility on it. And then when it comes to treasury services, as such, it is clearly said that treasury services are just seen as routine type of services. This also includes cash pooling. It includes even financing companies which are bearing liquidity risk and maybe even some credit risk. All those companies have to be seen as clear service providers. And to the extent that equity is used as a means to finance intercompany debt, that equity portion has to be remunerated by using a risk-free return, which again is in a clear contradiction to what the OECD says. We all know that the draft paper of Chapter 10 had some language about risk-free returns. But if I read the current paper correctly, then even when it comes to cost-plus pricing for intercompany loans, it is said that the margin has to consider a certain return on the equity which is at risk, which, as I say, is in clear contradiction to what is in the draft law of the Ministry of Finance.
Perfect. Thank you, Jörg. That's really helpful. I guess, Omar, if we move to you next in terms of the Netherlands and the perspective with respect to, again, local application and local legislation, but I'm interested in this point around implicit support and the points Jörg was mentioning there. How is implicit support taken into account from a Dutch perspective currently, and do you see this changing again going forward?
I think the Netherlands introduced the notion of implicit support already in its transfer pricing regulations back in 2013, where the transfer pricing decree was updated and an example was provided around intercompany loans and intercompany guarantees. And especially in the latter, the notion of implicit support was already addressed and how it is to be considered, and very much building on the standalone rating analysis, and then adjusting it upwards towards the group rating, considering the strategic importance of the subsidiary. So basically consistent with the guidance that we now see in the OECD guidelines in Chapter 10. What is interesting, though, is that in that same decree update back in 2013, the Netherlands did introduce a sort of a minimum credit rating to be considered of acceptable risk, being the investment grade threshold, so the BBB- rating. So every financing transaction entered into with a rate, and that was rated below that rating, required additional support in order to conclude on whether, on why the transaction was entered into in the first place, considering the risk profile and why it was still deemed at arm's length. Now, this distinction, of course, you do not see in the Chapter 10 guidance of the OECD. So it will be interesting to see whether whether that will be amended or updated in the Dutch transfer pricing rules to more align with the guidance in the OECD. Next to that, again, going back to the treasury functions or the financing activities, and where you see quite some guidance now in Chapter 10 about appropriately remunerating financing entities, especially for, let's say, borrowing and non-lending type of activities with solely performing an intermediary role. Here, the guidance in the OECD seems to identify that this is an activity that should be remunerated by no more than a cost-based type of compensation. I'm specifically referring to the example that is included in paragraph 1046, whereas the Dutch rules actually prescribe that such entities or such activities are to be compensated for both functions and risks, so potentially creating a misalignment between the Dutch regulations and the guidance that the OECD has put out there. And on top of that, we also have state aid cases with, again, a different approach to the same type of structure. So interesting to see how all these developments will work out going forward.
That's great. Thank you, Omar. Really interesting. So then, Michael, maybe come to you last. Then, in terms of South Africa, you mentioned previously in terms of the legislation there and how things have worked historically. Are you seeing a big change then coming down the line in relation to this paper and how it's going to impact things from your perspective?
In a word, no, because a lot of what's in this paper is to some extent codifying what has been the OECD's sort of thinking processes over the last few years, and it's resolving some of the areas of dispute. In other parts, I think it's broad enough that there's still going to be lots of fights on how it's going to get interpreted. But our big change came a few years ago when we moved away from simple safe harbors into this general arm's length pricing of debt. And the revenue then said, well, it's all got to be arm's length. And everybody said, well, what does that mean? They said, whatever the OECD eventually decides. I think what's going to be interesting is how this gets applied in practice, both in South Africa and even more interestingly in a lot of the African countries, outside of South Africa where they say, look, we follow OECD principles. But when you start looking at, like I gave the exchange control example earlier, but there's lots of other things where the almost tick the box methodology, and I hesitate to use that term, but a more simplified approach, which I think David was mentioning that people must be wary of, those simplified approaches don't necessarily work in jurisdictions where your interest rates are way higher than your data is available. So if you look at interest cover ratios, we get interest cover ratios, we get US, UK, Europe data, where your interest rates are, you know, what, 2, 3, 4%, and we're running at 12%, and if you go into some of the other countries, much, much higher than that. So your comparable data doesn't talk to what you're managing to get. So there it's interesting, how do you work around that and look at it more broadly? And I do get the feeling from this paper that the OECD is saying, take a step back, look at all of the facts and circumstances around the lending, both from the borrower and the lender's perspective, and come to, I mean, they don't use the term because I think in tax it's naive to say come to a common sense conclusion, but they do say take everything into account. And I, as I say, naively hope that a common sense practical conclusion can be drawn if one takes all the facts into account. And that's, I think, where a lot of the BEPS type of thinking here on cash pooling, fronting on, you know, captive insurers, that sort of thinking is coming from governments who are saying, hang on, guys, these guys are totally overcharging. It just doesn't make sense. Something's wrong. And the paper's trying to deal with some of that. So I think as a whole, it's going to be interesting to apply all of it in all the jurisdictions, but I think it may get to more sensible solutions if one can spend the time to look at all of those facts and circumstances. The trick is to try and do all of that if the amounts of the loan aren't so big, and it, you know, then you've got a clash between the amount of effort needed to get to a sensible approach and what budget somebody can spend to actually get to that answer.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you, Michael. And I suppose one of the other challenges we've seen in recent years in relation to South African comparables and African region comparables more generally is it's often difficult to find debt issuances within that region. So often we look for debt issuances outside of the region, for example, looking at US dollar issuances, and then trying to make adjustments for that. So talking about the practical approach here, do you see that as being some part of that practical approach also on the interest rate pricing side, is being able to utilize comparables from other regions, other markets, and make reasonable adjustments to come to something which can be applicable for these markets?
Absolutely, because if you just lift the data straight, which is what the normal approach would be, it doesn't make sense when you start applying it to your ratios in country, and you've got to say, well, why doesn't it make sense? How do I adapt it so that things are more usable? The other interesting thing is they saying that the risk-free rate of return isn't necessarily a government bond. I mean, you will find throughout the African continent that very often the blue chip multinational who's making these loans, that blue chip multinational's credit rating is going to be significantly higher than a government bond. So how does that then play into it? And you've got to apply some sort of a common sense approach to this to say, right, how do we adapt that to a different reality?
Yeah, understood. Makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Michael. So then maybe just to bring things to a close, if I could ask each of you to give a quick thought as to what are the key couple of takeaways that you'd be giving to clients right now? What do they need to be thinking about in the short term, let's say over the next few months? David, again, coming to you first, if that's okay.
I think what's important is that groups and also advisors, they typically look to financial transactions on a transactional basis, one loan, and they most often only consider the borrower. I think the key takeaway is that you should not only look to that specific transaction, but also how that links in the broader context, both for the borrower and the lender. So an assessment of the overall treasury setup on the one hand and the overall situation of the war on the other hand is key. If you then look to specific transactions, we mentioned a lot cash pools, and it will be important that you are able to demonstrate to tax authorities what are the risks linked to that cash pool, who has actually control over those risks, so the substance questions. And then, are there synergies and should they be reallocated or not? To the extent that they should be reallocated, you should come with a methodology. And you might remember that in the discussion draft, there were a couple of methods provided to reallocate those synergy effects. You will notice that in the final document, that guidance is out. So there's even more uncertainty now on how to actually allocate those synergies. During the discussion, we didn't touch upon all transactions, but maybe just worthwhile to mention some of them. There's guidance on guarantees, and here it's important to understand the driver of the guarantee. And then, for example, OECD is saying that if the driver of the guarantee is to increase the debt capacity of a borrower, even if that debt is a third-party debt, then there's a complex explanation of a recharacterization, but bottom line of it means that if that borrower would not have obtained that amount of debt without the guarantee, then a part of the interest burden should be shifted to the guarantor. So that's a quite interesting view. There's also some guidance on captives, whether you should truly consider the intercompany captive as a captive or not. In the documents, of which the OECDs say that all or substantially all should be respected. So it's also worldwide to look at those captive companies. And then to conclude a more general remark, it's importance of transparency and consistency. In the OECD documents, reference is made that various in various parts to the group treasury policy. How does a group finance itself externally? How does it manage the financial risks of the group? And that information might give some inspiration on how to structure intercompany financing. So their consistency is extremely important. And obviously, these days, tax authorities have much more information than they had before with the master file exchange of information country by country and the like. So if you have an approach in a group, you better ensure that that approach is applied in a fairly consistent way.
That's great. Thank you, David. You'll continue next.
I have two recommendations. First recommendation would be consider to do a comprehensive FTTP risk analysis based on the new Chapter 10. And the second recommendation would be think about extending the documentation approach to a more comprehensive documentation, which essentially covers all the things Michael mentioned a few minutes ago. When it comes to the first thing, risk assessment, I'm in particular thinking about structures where you have a FinCo, which is handling all the intercompany loans in the group. The FinCo is rather lean in terms of substance, people functions, and so on the one hand. But at the same time, the borrowing rates, the interest rates are determined based on a pure standalone rating approach, meaning also that you have pretty high spreads in the FinCo, where you have borrowers with pretty high interest rates, some others with maybe lower interest rates, depending on the individual ratings. I don't think those structures will survive in the future, given the fact that the OECD points out this the implicit support concept and requires to look at each and every transaction in more detail. And then also when it comes to cash pooling, I'm thinking about structures where significant spreads are with the FinCo or with the Treasury Center without documenting the, let's say, the functional substance behind that, just referring to CUP analysis where one says that there is the deposit rate, which is close to the bank rate, and we have a borrowing rate, which is close to a short-term borrowing bank rate, and then the spread is earned in the middle. That is maybe something which doesn't survive as well in the future. So that would be the risk assessment part, the specific structures I would recommend looking at in detail. And then when it comes to documentation, yeah, I think taxpayers cannot ignore that there are a lot of details to be looked at, and that that therefore our documentation approach has to be much more comprehensive than, let's say, the loan benchmarking, which traditionally was the basis of ETP documentation. I think in the future there will be much more quantitative and qualitative aspects for documentation.
Okay, thank you, Jörg. Omar, some thoughts from you?
I can only echo what David and Jörg have already mentioned. I think the most dominant transactions that we encounter within non-financial multinationals, of course, provision of funding, so the intercompany loans and the cash pool structures that are in place. And it's good to take notice of the new detailed guidance that the OECD has put out around accurately delineating these transactions and accurately delineating the role and compensation of the header in a cash pool structure. And I think it's important to realize that this guidance, again, as I said at the very beginning, this guidance will be applied also to historic transactions. So it's important to assess through a sort of a gap or risk analysis that Jörg referred to, where the main sensitivities potentially are within your group financing transactions and in your group financing policies. And from there, identify against, let's say, the guidance that the OECD has now put out, okay, where are updates necessary in order to ensure that going forward, we end up in arm's length transactions, both in terms and conditions, volume, and ultimately also pricing.
Thank you, Omar. And Michael, coming to you last but not least, your final thoughts?
I think, South Africa and most of the African countries very much is going to be the same sort of thing that everyone else has said. What I want to caution people against is people sometimes say, oh, well, the revenue authorities haven't got the skills to police this, to understand it, or to really get to grips and attack us on this. Bear in mind that you are not structuring for an investigation today by the revenue. Your structuring that you put in place now is going to be looked at it by revenue in 3 years' time. Yes, they can't use hindsight, but the thinking will and the skills and that are going up all the time. And you need to make sure that you have a sound structure that can withstand an attack from a sophisticated revenue, because revenues are getting more and more sophisticated. And the last thing would be to say, you can have all the fancy structures you like. Also, take a step back, look at the big picture, apply some common sense. And if the thing doesn't look right, and if you say, you know what, all the individual parts, yes, the boxes are ticked, but overall, I'd never get into a deal like that if I was either the borrower or the lender, whichever side. Then, if it doesn't pass that smell test, then go back and look at it again, because you probably missed something. Revenues and these papers have got a lot more sophisticated to close down on loopholes and base erosion and profit shifting. The landscape has changed from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and it's narrowing down more and more.
Fantastic. Thank you, Michael. And thank you to all of my speakers today. I think we've certainly got some food for thought. Thank you all for tuning in to listen to us today. And please do look out for the other regional podcasts in this series, which will be covering the Americas and also the Asia Pacific regions.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.